The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello, good morning everybody. This is Richard Martin. It's the wake up call time from Singapore. And I am sure that a lot of you would hope that I have something very, very nice to say in advance, in anticipation of your Labor Day weekend. And from all accounts, it's going to be very nice all over the United States. It's certainly nice weather here. And wouldn't it be nice if I had some nice things to say about the economy and the world in which we live? Well, I don't. And in fact, some of you will be listening live, others will be listening over the weekend, doubtless. It would be presumptuous of me to try to lead you into la-la land with things which are absolutely so grave and so serious that it just doesn't bear even hardly thinking about. But what I did think that I would do today is I would start to talk by talking about the pundits and the way in which they, you know, do their business and how they come to say what they have to say. And I thought I would take as an example of that the case of Jeremy Siegel. Now, some of you will have heard who he is. He is a very, very influential Wall Street hack. Very bright, obviously. He went to Columbia. He got his PhD in economics. He went to MIT, and he is now a professor at the Wharton School of Business. He's a columnist. He's a broadcaster. He's always bullish. He wrote a tome called Stocks for the Long Run back in the 1990s. He has won many awards writing. He worked 15 years at J.P. Morgan teaching other people economics. And so you would think that this is a man who is eminently capable of telling us what's happening, what's going to happen, how things are going to be. I mean, wouldn't you like to have a doctor who was so exquisitely qualified to work on your body when you are in sickness and not in health? Yes, I'm sure you would. But when it comes to economics, ladies and gentlemen, we have to start to look in a different direction. And I mentioned this before, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about this man, because I think he represents a master plan for economists in general when it comes to being in the limelight as much as he is. And of course you must wonder why a man like that would be in the limelight, because if he was the egghead that his training would make him out to be, you would think that he could see through all the BS and really get to the heart of the matter and come out with some really interesting stuff. But then you have to remember that such people do not get to go on CNBC and Bloomberg and CNN and all these other mainstream media providers, because they simply don't play the game. And so, you know, who is Jeremy Siegel? I mean, what is, in fact, going on in his mind? I mean, what does he think about? He gets up in the morning like the rest of us do, I assume. He, you know, goes and washes up. He gets dressed in nice clothes like all successful people in economics and Wall Street do. He probably has, I know nothing about his personal life, but I'm sure he has a wife. He probably has children. He has breakfast. He says bye-bye to his wife, and he tells his children, you know, to work hard, and he gets in his car and he drives off towards his office in Wall Street or wherever he works. And as he's driving away, I bet he thinks to himself, you know, I'm so lucky. I have this wonderful life that I've made for my family. You know, I know what I have to do. I'm successful because I do the right things. I say the right things. I meet the right people. And now, you know, I'm on my way to my office. What have we got today? Oh, yeah, we have an interview coming up with Bloomberg, and I know they're going to want to talk about the economy, and everybody's very bullish, aren't they? I mean, there's Obama now thinking, you know, that we've got this recovery summer. This is what it's supposed to be all about for the Obama administration. Prosperity just around the corner. What can we talk about today? Oh yes, the unemployment figures came out, and oh, guess what? The figures themselves were down. Well, you know, the unemployment rate went up a bit, but I can find something. What can I say? I want some promotion. I want to be liked, well liked, and my family and everything. So, without being too presumptuous, ladies and gentlemen, this is the kind of thing that these people. It must be thinking, you know, as often as not when they go into these studios and they start to spout off, you know. And it is interesting, you know, when you think about what people are expected to say in the mainstream, what the real pundits are all about. Because back in the 1950s, you know, there was a great deal of talk about the Great Depression. Everybody would be fresh from the memories of the Great Depression. Nobody took a loan. Nobody had outstanding debts. People were incredibly careful with how they spent money. But before that, the interesting thing is that everybody was exactly like they are today. They had unrealistic attitudes. They said, for example, the 1929 stock market crash was just a temporary dip. You can read all the reports. They're all there. I've mentioned them on the show. They're in books. They're on the web. I mean, you can find out what the eminences of the day were talking about and how they were basically talking up the economy and the markets. The market would go up again the following week or the following month, or prosperity was just around the corner, and they just got it wrong. And how many people, you know, consistently got everything wrong time after time? And you would think, with all that, that the people of today would have learnt their lessons from these people's mistakes. They know we had a crash like in 1929. They know there was a real estate bubble just like there was in the mid-1920s. They know that industry was overextended. All of these things were the same, were identical to the way they were in those days. But yet they make the same mistakes over and over again. You know, it is quite fascinating, actually, when you think now that they're talking about this recovery summer, and how they bet all their chips on the same ridiculous strategy. You know, they push through this monstrous healthcare bill, which is going to cost more money than you can even imagine in terms of the budget that has been described for the current year. They waste all their time and effort on all of these things because they really, really believe that the economy is going to recover dramatically this summer. You know, and in fact, prosperity has always just been round the corner since the financial crisis began in 2007. You know, there were people on CNBC and Bloomberg constantly saying that the economy would pick up in one or two quarters. First it would be the last half of 2008, then it would be early 2009, then it would be the last half of 2009, then it would be early 2010. You know, and now we have the recovery summer, you know. Isn't it amazing to be living through this? Can you believe it? To see, you know, this whole thing that was warned against by people in the 1950s who begged people to get away from this awful habit. And they've, you see, all died now. They've gone. You see, they died in the 1990s. They kind of all died together. And so the field is left open for the same ridiculous mantras of optimism to be trundled out, you know, just like before. And then in comes our friend Jeremy Siegel, you know, and now it's time for him to come on because he's going to be on the air. You know, it's, well, Tuesday basically of last week on Bloomberg TV, there's Jeremy Siegel, professor of finance at the Wharton School of Business. You know, the interview actually really encapsulates everything that's wrong with the analysts of today, the journalists, the professors. He seems to have learned nothing from his own past mistakes. You know, the book that he wrote, Stocks for the Long Run, in the 1990s, fresh edition in 2002, absolutely unswayed by his ridiculous bullishness and optimism. Back at it all over again. Well, just a few of the things that happened in that interview. You know, the questioner started out asking, the Fed is expressing caution, but you continue to be upbeat. What is it that you're seeing that the Fed is not? And then Siegel, now, you know, he suspected this question was coming. He's in his element. So he says the following. He says, and I quote, I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, when I quote and when I unquote him, so that you can really distinguish between what this moron says and what it is that I have to say about what he says. So, quote, first of all, I am disturbed that there is so much debate about whether they should use quantitative easing if this slowdown continues. This surprised me. I did not think we were going to have this slowdown. I do think we're going to have an acceleration by the fourth quarter for a number of reasons. I want the Fed to be ready to use more QE, that's quantitative easing, without a fight in the FOMC, which is the Federal Open Market Committee of the Federal Reserve. I think Ben Bernanke was right. It looked like he moved to an easing status from his speech at Jackson Hole. But he obviously has opposition in the FOMC if he wants to move further. I think that is unfortunate because we're not getting clarity on the fiscal side with the taxes, which I think is a very big negative for the markets, particularly the equity markets. I want at least a proactive monetary authority that is ready to move if it feels it has to. End of quote. Well, see, here's where I see the basic internal contradiction in his reasoning that I find it's so puzzling. He thinks that we're going to have what he called an acceleration in the fourth quarter for a number of reasons, remember? But then he says that he wants to apply stimulus in the form of quantitative easing. So what is this man saying? I mean, who do you believe? Which part of what he says do you believe? You can't believe both. Does he believe there will be an acceleration in the fourth quarter with or without quantitative easing? Or is quantitative easing a precondition? It's absolutely impossible to tell from his interview which he means. And you see, that's the point when you begin to wonder whether the guy is actually lying just to get on television. I mean, you know, it's not good enough. Anybody who thinks, who is a thinking person, will not accept what he said in that first quote that I gave you, ladies and gentlemen. It is unacceptable. It would be pulled apart if it was used in evidence in court by a cross-examining attorney. It's nonsense. It is absolute gibberish. He is just saying that because he knows that nobody will pick up on it, and that he's doing his job, which is to get everybody pleased with him, both in the studio and in his company, and that will help in his popularity stakes and in whatever degree of promotion he thinks he can get, and of course on his own personal financial bottom line, of course. Now, let me be very specific about this quantitative easing thing, okay? That's, otherwise known as money printing, all right? The way that quantitative easing works is that the Fed purchases bonds and other financial assets from companies in order to give them cash. That's how they get cash into the systems. For example, if a bank holds $1 billion...
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists strive for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Progressives, this is Betsy Rosenberg on the Green Front. I hope you've been enjoying the news I'm bringing you hot off the press, so to speak, like behind-the-scenes stories and insider scoop from Al Gore's recent climate conference. I know the Greenistas and love introducing the most informative and inspiring experts on the Green Front every week. So join me as we learn more about our environment and what we can do to turn it around.
The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, every Wednesday at 2 on the Progressive Radio Network. This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry, this is Richard Martin. I really am sorry about that. Don't know what happened. I have absolutely no idea. So I'm talking about Jeremy Siegel. Basically, I don't even actually know exactly the point at which I got disconnected here. But as I was saying, he has a complete dichotomy in his comments about whether, in fact, quantitative easing is needed or not. And it's impossible to tell, you know, whether in order for there to be an acceleration in the fourth quarter, quantitative easing is needed or whether it isn't. And that you wonder, you know, whether basically the guy is lying in order to get on TV. Now, I mentioned this to you, and I was actually about to talk to you about what quantitative easing is and how it works. And so I will actually take up from that point, because I think that's where we got cut off. The way the quantitative easing works is that the Fed purchases bonds and other financial assets from companies in order to give them cash. For example, if a bank holds $1 billion in mortgages on its books, the Fed could purchase the mortgages so that the bank would have $1 billion in cash to buy more mortgages. Now, this, ladies and gentlemen, is what Jeremy Siegel is proposing. He's proposing that the Fed purchase all the securitized loans that the banks have on their books, credit card loans, mortgages, etc., so that the banks will have enough money to make more loans. He calls this lowering of risk premiums. That is, making it less risky for banks to make loans. Well, there are two problems with this proposal. One is that it's already been tried, and the Fed had a couple of $1 trillion of assets on its books, but nothing came of it. It didn't work. The second problem is that the mood of the public has changed, and it's increasingly opposed to these unchecked and uncontrolled stimulus and bailout programs. So then he went and could defend quantitative easing in the case of Japan, and again I quote, "I think we would get bang for the buck. I think quantitative easing got a bad rap. People say it failed in Japan. The truth of the matter is it really didn't fail in Japan. They planned to actually stop after a given period. It did stop the deflation, and I think it would support prices and assets and the economy if we moved forward on that." End of quote. Now that's an absolutely remarkable statement. Japan has recently announced its 17th consecutive month of deflation. Japan is still in a deflationary spiral 20 years after its stock market bubble crashed in 1990. So what on earth does Siegel mean? Well, his sentences actually were fairly garbled, so perhaps he meant that Japan only tried QE or quantitative easing for a while. And while it was going on, it stopped deflation. But even in that interpretation, it misses the point. What these stimulus and bailout programs are supposed to do is jumpstart the economy so that the bailout programs can start and the economy can become self-sustaining. If that doesn't happen, if the money is simply wasted and doesn't do any permanent good, then what's the point of spending the money? You're only using up resources and wasting them. This situation with Japan is really serious and ought to give anyone pause. Ben Bernanke is known to have believed that deflation is impossible in any economy based on a fiat currency, that is, currency not limited by some gold standard. In such a case, according to the theory, the central bank can just issue as much money as necessary to prevent deflation from occurring. And what is so fantastically amazing about all this is that so many economists still believe this, even though the Japan case clearly proves that it's wrong. What's wrong with these idiots? How can Siegel point to the Japan case that so clearly invalidates his case? One of the problems that Siegel identifies is that more clarity is needed on taxes, and he's counting on Congress to provide that clarity. He was asked why on earth he believes that's going to happen. Quote, "Well, something's got to be decided on taxes. I think that the market is anticipating absolutely the worst, a total lapse in the pro-Bush taxes, which is a sharp increase in taxes, which is not going to be good for stocks and the economy. I don't think it's going to be that bad. I think there's a game of chicken going on between the Democratic Congress and the Republicans. And I personally think the Democrats are going to have to step back, because this election is not looking good for them unless they bring some clarity for the economic outlook. So I do think we're going to get some resolution there." And this worst-case scenario, which I think that investors are now looking at, is not going to materialize. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is about as close to fantasy as I can imagine. There's a great deal of political debates these days as to whether to extend the Bush tax cuts that will expire on January the 1st. Obama was highly critical of these tax cuts during the campaign, and he'd rather have all his teeth pulled than see them extended. There's no chance that they'll be extended before the November elections, though there is the possibility that they'll be extended after that, before January the 1st. But that will be too late for Siegel's scenario. So what Siegel's saying is total nonsense. See, the thing is, here am I'm on a, you know, radio show talking about Siegel, and I kind of go into his language, and I enunciate his words, and I sort of take them seriously. But don't forget, he doesn't speak like that, ladies and gentlemen. He doesn't talk, you know, as though he meant every word he says. He speaks like this. Oh, something's got to be decided. I'm not using American accent, of course. I wouldn't presume to try. But, you know, something's got to be done on taxes. I think the market's anticipating absolutely the worst, a total lapse in the pre-Bush taxes, which is a sharp increase in taxes, which is not going to be good for the stocks and the economy. I don't think it's going to be that bad. See, he talks fast and slurring over the words so that you don't really hear what he's saying, and you certainly don't pick it up word for word and start analyzing it to bring out the real meaning. That's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to sit there, you know, in a kind of glazed stupor while this guy, you know, lords it over you on television and tells you, you know, in a few sharp, slick phrases, the answers to the predictable questions from the interviewer, you know. And, you know, it's sickening because they all do this, and it's all nonsense. And you know, once again, you have to wonder, what does Siegel believe? Does he believe there'll be prosperity in the fourth quarter no matter what happens in Washington? Or does he set these impossible preconditions? Or is he just lying? I mean, you just can't know. All I know is that he's reciting the same kind of nonsense that one can hear all day from the same financial experts on TV. And believe me, the scenario I painted about when he comes to work in the morning, that's what's going on here, ladies and gentlemen. Is he lying, or is he just positing ideas and concepts that he knows perfectly well could not be proved to be either right or wrong, and if they don't happen, people will have forgotten that he said them in the first place, and if they do happen, then he can trumpet his success story all over, you know, kingdom. You know? Many analysts, by the way, are concerned that GDP growth is going to turn negative in the third quarter, which, of course, indicates what they call their double-dip recession, which, of course, is non-existent because we've been in a recession all the time. So if this is the dip, then this is the greatest dip that anybody could ever have hoped to have when, you know, picking up their ice cream and dipping it in the chocolate or whatever they do with it, you know. But not Jeremy Siegel, and I quote what he says again. I still do not think a double dip recession is in the offing, and I still think that the fourth quarter we're going to see 3% growth in GDP, and that's going to bring us momentum into 2011. So we have really a two-quarter soft patch. We've had them before, coming out of recessions. I think we'll get a little clarity again on the fiscal side. He loves his clarity, doesn't he? If the Fed isn't afraid to do some more quantitative easing just to bring down some of those risk premiums. I think the market is really looking for that. And that's what we need to turn the psychology a little bit positive. I think when people see the world is not falling apart and that we can move forward in our economies, that's when the recovery is really going to start in earnest. I think that this quarter, the third quarter, is going to be slow again, but I see an acceleration of 3% into the fourth quarter and 3 to 3.5% in 2011. And that's what I think will bring the markets back once investors see its growth. End of quote. You see, the truth is that all that represents the heart of his reasoning. There's nothing there. There is no reasoning. The fall in GDP doesn't matter because we've had soft patches before. We'll get a little clarity on the fiscal side because Congress will do as he demands. Throw in a little psychology and happy days are here again. It's all puff. It's nonsense. It's gibberish, ladies and gentlemen. You wouldn't pass an exam at the age of 5 years old with that kind of reasoning. You certainly wouldn't get a PhD in economics, and I'll talk another time, by the way, about how you get a PhD in economics and what it takes in economics to get a PhD. And it certainly doesn't take what I have to say, I can assure you of that. Anyway, in the end, he predicted that the S&P 500 index would rise to 1250 or 1300 by the end of this year. He had expected the stock market to be much higher at this time, but he says he was wrong about that. But he asserted that he's right about what will happen by the end of this year. This time, it is different. All right, let me just explain. Let me emphasize a few things I've pointed out many times before. Mainstream economists like Siegel didn't predict or explain the tech bubble or why it occurred in 1995 instead of 1985 or 2005. They didn't predict and can't explain the real estate bubble, the credit freeze, the financial crisis, or the worldwide trade and transportation freeze. They can't explain what's happening today, and they have no idea what's coming next year. Everything they say is either lies or guesswork, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I wanted to present this whole thing about Siegel, a really in-depth analysis of what this guy has to say, just to show you how vacuous these people are. You know, but what about that puzzle that's so bothersome since the 1950s. I mean, does that yield an answer as to what's going on today and what happened in the 1930s? See, one thing that you get when you listen to people like Siegel or any of the people that you see on CNBC or Bloomberg or CNN or whatever, is that they have absolutely no historical grasp whatsoever. History is not even a word in the dictionary for these people. They believe that economic problems are caused by some kind of public malaise and that if only you can snap people out of it, then the economy will return to normal. In the case of the stock market, I'd noted before that analysts think that only the past 200 days of stock prices are relevant to what's going to happen next. See, what happened in 1929 is that the stock market crash and subsequent Great Depression created a risk-averse generation that almost never went into debt. And as I said to you just now, by the 1990s, these people had all gone. They'd all disappeared. They'd either retired or died. And it's so strange, they all seemed to disappear at the same time. Because they left behind a generation born after the Great Depression who had absolutely no sense of the dangers of the abusive use of debt. And the mainstream economists and the way they teach economics yields no concept of this. And I've said this many times to you, ladies and gentlemen. You must be getting sick of me hearing me say this. These people don't understand how the Great Depression created a population wave that's affecting us today. They cannot grasp that a generation born in the 1920s and 30s has completely different attitudes towards money and debt from the generation born in the 1960s and 70s, and how that can mean worse today is far, far from over. Right, this is it. It's 10:30, both your time and my time, except that you're in the morning and I am at night. And we are due for a break, and a break we shall have, and I'll be right back.
Progressive Radio Network. Information for the independent mind.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hello, this is Eric Ostner, your host of the best jazz show on the air. On Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Hi, this is Karen Hartglass, host of It's All About Food on the Progressive Radio Network. Please join me every Wednesday at 3 p.m. when we talk about the power of the fork, how our food choices affect our health, the environment, and the treatment of animals. Learn how a plant-based diet of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds is not only delicious, but gentle on the planet.
This is John Rappaport inviting you to my new radio show on the Progressive Radio Network, which will air every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm an investigative reporter. I've spent 20 years researching health and medical fraud, deep politics. I'll have lots of very knowledgeable guests on the show who have information to share with you so that you can live a more healthy and informed life. Join me every Wednesday on PRN, that's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the John Rappaport Show. See you then.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent points of view.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm back. It's Richard Martin. I need to give you my information so you know who I am, in case you didn't know. This is Richard Martin with the wake-up call, and it's, where are we, Friday, September the 3rd, and the call-in number, for those of you who would like to ask questions and give us some of your mind, which we always enjoy, we welcome, I encourage it, and I give you your time, so please don't feel constrained. If you've got something to say, please call in and say it. And you have a toll-free number with which to do this, which is 888-874-4888. Once again, the toll-free number for your help is 888-874-4888. If you'd like to email me, my email line is open, and it is rm@gfawd.com. That's Richard Martin at Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. That's what the letters stand for. And once again, the email address is rm@gfawd.com. And if you would like to call me in private and talk about your financial situation, you may do that too. My direct line through Sarasota, Florida is, and I give it to you directly with its area code, 941-441-1682. Once more, 941-441-1682. Now, just a little housekeeping note here. I am going to take a couple of days off. We're going to go, my wife and I are going to go to a little Indonesian island very close here, about 50 minutes away on a boat, and we shall be spending 2 days, so I will not be around on Monday with a show, but my engineer has very graciously agreed to record a show immediately after this one is over, and so I shall do that. I shall be recording your Monday show immediately after this, and so it will be made available to you in the usual way, 10 a.m. Monday morning, as usual. But please remember not to call in, because there won't be anybody to answer your questions. But other than for that, we now have a caller, and I see he's online. His name is Chris from New Haven, who would like to comment about the public perception and how surreal it is. Chris, hello, good morning,
hi.
And welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Richard. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I certainly appreciate everything that that you do for us. I can't imagine how blind I would be without this knowledge. But I was just wanting to talk about how surreal it is just to go around, you know, either driving around or when I'm working at the grocery store, and people just don't seem to get how bad things are, and how bad they can get. As you see more houses closing here and there, and I see the prices falling where I work, and it just, no one seems to get it, because everything that we're told is to the contrary.
Oh, they get it, Chris. Oh, they get it? Okay, don't worry about that. They get it. The people that can't get it, they know very well what's going on. But they won't tell you, because it's not in their interest to do so. It's just like the case that I've mentioned to spend half an hour talking about Jeremy Siegel. He knows perfectly well what's going on. He knows better than anybody. He could slay me if I pretended to be Jeremy Siegel and Jeremy Siegel pretended to be me, and we would have a conversation. He would slay me. He would have all the arguments that I have for him. He would have those arguments. He knows them all, and he would just throw them right back at me, and I would not be in a position even to come close to arguing with him. He is much brighter than me. He has far more knowledge than I ever could hope to have. These people know it all. I mean, you know, it's like the doctors in your country. They are the greatest drug pushers of them all. They know the harm these drugs do. They know perfectly well what harm they do. They know that half the people they provide the drugs to are potentially addicts, and they're going to get addicted to the drugs they provide. But they see these, you know, advantages dancing in front of their eyes, the bribes that these pharmaceutical companies put up in front of them. They have all different motives for doing the things they do, but they're not pure, and they're not in your best interest. You are not surrounded by good people, I'm afraid, in your country. I hate to tell you, Chris, but that's one of the reasons why I left, because I was so sick of putting up with all the nonsense that I knew I couldn't possibly come to oppose. You know, and that's why I feel so strongly. That's why I'm so grateful and glad to have PRN that have provided me, you know, with a platform to expose some of this stuff.
Yes, there's a great saying, you know, hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. But as a country, we don't seem to do that, especially, I mean, I don't want to blame it all on the government, but especially in government. We just hope for the best and prepare for the best. When it doesn't happen, we're left just without any recourse.
Yes, but you see, this is this whole thing about hope again, Chris. What is this hope? What is it? You know, did you listen to the I had people listen to I've forgotten his name now. There's a guy, one of these motivational speakers. His name will come to me in a moment.
I remember the episode. I remember you saying it. I haven't gotten around to actually listen to his show. Was it Anthony Robbins?
Yeah, the name just escaped me. I can't remember. But he very cleverly, he corralled this whole hope scenario into being creative about what you can hope for. I mean, you can't hope for things which are hopeless, which have no essence of coming to pass. So what you have to do is you have to hope, yes, of course, because hope is essential in life. But you have to hope for things which are realistic, and you have to try to organize and arrange your life such that they become realistic, that the things you hope for are realistic. But you see, as you say, when you hope for the best, that is a little package deal that is presented to you by the powers that be, the best being what they tell you the best is going to be, not what the actual best is, but what they want you to think is the best, because that's what serves their interest. It serves the interests of the moneyed, the banks, it serves the interests of industry, and it serves the interests of government. They know what they want you to hope for, but it's not your best interests that they're asking you to hope for. It's their best interest, and everybody is suckered into this.
Yeah, I entirely agree. I happen to play for the Yale graduate rugby team, and so I know a number of PhD students in economics, and it's unfortunate. I talk to them about this stuff all the time. But while they're more pessimistic than the mainstream media, they're still getting all this same information as far as, you know, the positive stuff, and all the professors are telling them to think this way. And so even they seem to be, you know, not looking at the worst-case scenario and what could happen. And I think that's unfortunate, because the more people that look at this from a perspective of realism, I think the better position we'd be in. But that doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah, but it depends who you are, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Who is it? Who, by the way, the person that I mentioned, I just got IM'd by my wife. It's Tony Robbins. That's the guy who very brilliantly turned the whole concept of this hope thing round, so that you could hope for something which was realistically achievable, as opposed to, you know, the grand hope that everything's going to be okay again, you know. But yes, I mean, obviously, you know, you have to be careful. You need to know. You've got to be aware. And that's why, you know, my own interpretation of the hope that people have is that they leave the country. And that is my answer. You've got to consider that the whole system has degenerated to such a degree that it's irretrievable. You cannot expect people to turn around, certainly this generation or the next, and admit that they were wrong and start again on a fresh course of action. It's not going to happen. And so if it isn't going to happen, Chris, then what alternative do you have? I'm perfectly happy to listen to anybody's alternatives, but as far as I'm concerned, there aren't any. The hope that exists has to be in a different paradigm and on a different shore, and an absolute decision to start again, to turn the tables entirely on these people that are trying to pull you into their little game, and just tell them, no thanks, this is not working for me, and I'm not going to be part of it, and you're not going to make me, because you can't force me to stay in the country. You can force, well, as long as I stay, you can force me to do what you want, because of course you can create tax incentives for me to do certain things, or, you know, make me educate me in a certain way, or educate my children in a certain way, and blindside me. Yes, you can do those things as long as I stay there. If I leave, however, you are absolutely blocked from any kind of influence you could possibly ever have over me. And that is what I intend to do. And this is what will become clear and much more apparent as time goes on, and as we see how this whole thing is played out, and how the nightmare is going to get worse and worse and worse, and how in the end I will feel so badly about it that I won't even tell you anymore how much I had begged you to leave the country, like I never mentioned the housing market anymore, because I feel so bad for people who didn't sell their houses that I was begging people to do, you know, 3 or 4 years ago.
Sure.
I'm not going to do that anymore because it's too cruel.
Yes, well, I'm certainly looking forward to moving. And fortunately, my girlfriend is excited as well. I've got to get through this program that I'm in school, and then we'll be taking off. But anyway, I'm very glad that my new schedule allows me to listen live, and thank you. Have a good vacation.
Thank you, and listen, thank you very much for calling in. I really do appreciate it. I admire so much people when they call in, because I know that it is somewhat confrontational, I guess, not in terms of my disagreeing with what you may say, although I would love to. I mean, I would love to have Jeremy Siegel call in on the air, except that, again, I don't think I'd be a match for him, because I think he'd know how to twist the arguments round using information which I just don't have time to collate. you know, have other work to do. So, but no, I mean, anybody who wants to call in, even if you disagree with me, I'm not going to attack you. I'm just going to discuss the issues as clearly as I can. And so, you know, Chris, thank you very much for the call, and good luck, and have a wonderful weekend.
Of course, thank you. All the best.
Thanks. Bye-bye now. Well, listen, I came across this, ladies and gentlemen, just the other day. Apparently, there's somebody who could be the most radical anti-war candidate in the U.S. It's not Dennis Kucinich. It's not Rand or Ron Paul or any of the usual suspects. It's a 42-year-old Vermonter named Dennis Steele who is running for governor of his state as an open secessionist. And from what I can tell, Steve is just an average kind of guy. He wears Carhartts and a baseball cap and drives a pickup truck and lives with his wife and two kids in a little Vermont village called Kirby, population 500, off in the wild hills of Vermont's northeast kingdom. On occasion, he feeds his family by hunting deer and butchering the meat himself. Seven other secessionist candidates are contending for seats in the state legislature. These include a consultant to Oracle, a former U.S. Army lieutenant, and an executive from one of the largest solar energy companies in the Northeast. A professor emeritus of economics from Duke University, Thomas Naylor, 74 years of age, a southerner by birth, bob-and-throwing contrarian by nature, is the white-haired intellectual voice of the movement, founder of the think tank Second Vermont Republic. The name is homage to the fact that there was a first Vermont Republic founded in 1777 as an independent nation and enduring for 14 years until 1791. How's that for a piece of history, ladies and gentlemen? I bet you didn't know. What the Vermonter secessionist present is something altogether more serious, a new paradigm in American politics, the rise of a left-wing populist peacenik secessionist movement, a leftism that rejects big government, that seeks not a takeover of the federal center, but an end to centralized power altogether. Call it a kind of green tea party, shorn of the gun fetishism, the blind rage, the know-nothingism. Or call it the thinking man's secession, arising as a reasonable answer to the cold facts of American national impasse. What's gone wrong with the U.S. government, argues the Vermonters, is that it has been totally captured by the corporatocracy, corrupted to the core, a lost cause, unreformable. Its laws are written by and for the rich and the powerful, whose predatory business models, Walmart, Monsanto, Goldman Sachs, etc., operate against the interests of average Vermonters. It blows Vermont's precious tax dollars in bailing out insolvent banks and piratical financiers, bombing children in Pakistan, kidnapping and torturing foreigners, slapping military bases on every continent, over 1,000 of them across 153 countries, etc., etc., ad nauseam, torturing foreigners. The Vermonter secessionists see no good future for the U.S., Instead, the country will likely flush itself down the toilet of its own corruption and hubris, ruined by unsustainable debt, unwinnable wars, military overstretch, pathological dependence on cheap oil. Objectives will say that Steele and his ilk are treasonous and crazy, that secession is illegal and unconstitutional, that Vermont would shrivel and die as a free republic, that it couldn't survive on its own, to which the secessionists answer that they're no more crazy than the colonists who founded the United States, who asserted a natural right of revolution, and who didn't wait for English parliamentarians and courts. Well, how about that? I don't know what you might feel about secessionism, but I feel that there is a really strong movement in that direction that I've understood coming from Texas, but we shall see. Anyway, I thought that was an interesting little piece for you, ladies and gentlemen. Well, Eve at Naked Capitalism reported the other day on some conversations with New York acquaintances that would either fall into or be familiar with the elite classes. And this is what she has to say. Normally, I don't report on anecdotes from my immediate circle, but a set of conversations in less than a 24-hour period suggests that even those comparatively unaffected by the crisis are bracing themselves for the possibility of sudden, large-scale adverse changes. And that sort of gnawing worry seems to be growing in New York, despite being buoyed by TARP funds and covert bank subsidies. When out on my rounds the day before yesterday, I ran into an old McKinsey colleague who had subsequently had impressively titled jobs in big firms you heard of before semi-retiring to manage family money. He and his very accomplished wife were both big Bush donors and had been invited to both inaugurations. He made short order of niceties and got to the point. We need more fiscal stimulus. Obama did too little and too much of what he spent on what was liberal pork. We could and need to spend a lot on infrastructure. This is looking a lot like 1936. I'm afraid it could get really ugly. And I'm particularly worried that the Republicans will win big this fall. They'll cut even deeper. That's the last thing we need right now. No, I'm not making this up. And yes, this is one of the last people I would have expected to express this line of thinking. Next day, I had lunch with two long-standing keen observers and participants in the New York scene, as in very involved in some of the city's important institutions. Both have witnessed the shift in values over the last 30 years and the rising stratification, particularly at the top end. New York has always been plutocratic, but it formerly had a large upper middle class and a much smaller and much less isolated upper crust. They started by commenting on my Bill Gross post, which had mentioned the appalling Steve Schwarzman contention that taxing private equity overlords more on their carried interest was like Hitler invading Poland. Schwarzman is not only retreating from this remark, he is convinced that the reason the economy is so lousy is that rich men like him are not getting their way. This is, if anything, an understatement of their account. Both men expect his head to be first on the pike. The conversation turned to whether the U.S. was going towards revolution or fascism. One argued for the continuation of trends underway, that the continuing weakness of the Obama administration and the discrediting of other members of the elite meant that there was a power vacuum. The obvious group to exploit it is the most strident, uncompromising opportunists, an area where the extreme right has a monopoly. The other, who has been reading up on the French Revolution, took issue with the conventional idea that a revolution is impossible in America. Quote, in France, the trigger was that people were hungry. We are closer to that point than most people think. End of quote. He stressed the desensitization to violence, video games, more and more violence, plus widespread gun ownership. And he pointed to rising and underreported crime in the city, for instance, assaults of cab drivers. He also noted that he believed that there were a lot of people, and he meant in the upper income strata, who were barely holding on, keeping up appearances and hoping that something would break their way. Well, some might get lucky, but most will hit the wall financially. Well, there's an interesting comment from one of the very best bloggers out there, which is Eve Smith, that many of you will have heard about. So that's very sobering, I think, if you really take seriously what's going on and accept that there are people, even very wealthy people, who are now beginning to wonder with very great concern as to how they are going to make out. Their savings are running out, they have massive expenses, and they're going to have to make some pretty dramatic and radical decisions before the year is out. And that came from me, ladies and gentlemen. You heard it here first. All right, well, we have a few minutes left, so I thought I would give you some mail, a little belatedly, but we're going to start with Steve Kruger, who's particularly prolific this week. He had no less than 1, 2, 3, 4 moments in his life when he felt constrained to write to me, so I shall give you all, one after the other. First email from Steve Kruger. Richard, a few years back I said in jest, if the government wanted to keep the public spending, simply give every taxpayer a $200,000 rebate, There won't be many 2010 taxpayers anyway. Besides, we have a debt that we will never repay. So what does it matter how much you default on $1 or $20 trillion? Uncle Ben is completely lost. When your plan B is just to repeat plan A, you're finished. Steve Kruger. Well, that's an interesting idea, isn't it, Steve? Just give away the, give the shop away. You're not going to be able to pay for it anyway. You might as well make up some more goods and services and hand them over. That's interesting idea. Next one. Richard, 13 million people watched the Emmys in the comfort of their homes on 55-inch flat screens. We must be thankful for all our technological advances. 2,100 years ago, we would have had to cram all those folks into the Colosseum to afford them a distraction from reality. We came a long way, baby. The result is the same. While we stare at the screen, we are having our pockets picked, just like Rome. Nothing really changes, just the players. Steve Kruger. Thank you, Steve. Third email. Richard, the government is working overtime in an attempt to keep house prices up and stimulate sales. Hardly a day goes by without word of some new plan to get the public to buy houses. Yes, Steve, you're absolutely right. It's just the same old thing. It's pushing the drugs of choice at people. And the government does a very good job, and they know how to do it. They've got lots of experience. Anyway, back to the email. I think back to when the dot-com bubble started to deflate, the pundits recommended that investors should take advantage of the price decline and, quote, dollar-cost average to make a bundle when the price goes back up. Those who took this advice are still feeling the pain. Buyer beware. If today you can buy a house that at one time was $400,000 for only $250,000, you'd better think twice. Prices have a long way to fall, and when they do, you're stuck with your $250,000 bargain. You could no more cost average a house than you could a dot-com stock when the bubble burst. If you have some bucks and you're young and have self-control, you will find a real bargain. This will take some time because the government has interfered with the deleveraging process. Yes, Steve, you can say that again. Richard's advice to rent is an outstanding call, and you will find that as time goes on, rents will fall, and the amount of square footage will go up. More bang for your buck. Some things in life can't be rushed. Short-term lease is okay as rents are coming down, not up. Steve Kruger. And the final email. Richard, it seems around the world car sales are up only when a government backs a nitwit rebate or the manufacturer offers a deal. When people are worried about losing their jobs, they're not going to run out and buy a car. Also, check out the price of gas in the USA. It's falling. Lack of demand. Without work, you only need a car to get to ShopRite and put food stamps to work. Steve Kruger. Yes, your prose gets more interesting by the day, Steve. Do keep it up. All right, Jordan Carr wrote in. He said, came up with a little pithy comment here. He said, the pessimist complains about the wind. The optimist expects it to change. The realist adjusts the sails. I like it. Thank you. That was from William Arthur Ward, apparently. Email from John Carr. And let me just tell you that the banks are not prepared for another wave of defaults, foreclosures, and write-downs. Bank lending continues to shrink, and the system is still fragile. A sudden turnaround in the equities market would expose the banks to severe losses and force the Fed to provide emergency liquidity for wobbling financial institutions. The solvency of the banking system is largely public relations hype. The fake stress tests merely obfuscated critical details about the true mark-to-market value of their assets. The nation's biggest banks are still wards of the state. Much of the rot at the heart of the financial system remains hidden from view. Accounting sleight of hand, gigantic liquidity injections, and regulatory forbearance have all helped to perpetuate the fraud. The Fed continues to divert capital into zombie institutions, which provide no capital, tangible public benefit. Low interest rates, government guarantees on bonds, interest rate payments on reserves, the Fed's discount window, and the myriad lending facilities are some of the perks, subsidies, inducements, and corporate welfare given to the banks at taxpayer expense. In return, the banks provide nothing, not even sufficient credit to generate another expansion. In its current configuration, the banking system is a net loss to society and a significant drag on growth. Last week, second quarter GDP was revised down to 1.6%. First quarter GDP was twice the size at 3.7%, while fourth quarter 2009 was higher still at 5%. The underlying trend is reasserting itself as growth turns to stagnation. The Fed doesn't have the tools to fix the ailing economy. That was an anonymous email. I'm sorry, I have no idea who wrote it, but I thought it was worth your attention. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin. Had a wonderful Labor Day weekend, and I shall speak to you remotely on Monday at 10 o'clock. Take care. Enjoy yourself. Bye-bye.